wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer a plowing hot and lone. I heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door. And the bolts are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, I'd like to welcome you to Progressive News Network. How you doing tonight? I've got a fine lineup of guests for you. We've got the incomparable political commentator and columnist, Ms. Brooke Hines. We've also got Luis Cuevas coming on tonight to talk about things and stuff in a progressive vein. I'm sure he's got plenty to comment on, given some of the recent activities. And we've also got Melinda Hemmelgarn back, and she's going to be talking about healthy holiday eating. A wonderful topic for these times. And before I go too much further, I'm going to bring on that special guest of ours. And let me bring her on with a little teaser of music. Hello there, Brooke. How you doing tonight? What do you say we fire up that mic? Brooke, welcome.
Hey, it's good to hear your voice.
Yep. It's we're still clearing out the engine, so to speak. Well, has been one exciting week or two for progressives. What's been on your front burner?
Well, I'll tell you what moved to my front burner this week pretty fast was the shooting in Colorado Springs at the Planned Parenthood clinic. I know took a lot of people by surprise, and the way the news unfolded was unexpected, to say the least. You know, if you were following what was going on, There was some back and forth as to what was going on. There was a lot of uncertainty as events were unfolding. And a lot of that had to do with the politics on the ground, because the state's attorney there is a pro-lifer, and there's very conservative politics in Colorado Springs. There's a history of militarism in Colorado Springs that has bled into the political climate. So what appeared to be a real kind of clear-cut situation at first, as some of these entities started getting involved on the ground in reporting what was happening, what seemed to be clear-cut, that there was a shooter at a Planned Parenthood clinic, started to get kind of fuzzy. And all of a sudden it was, oh, well, maybe it's a bank. And maybe it's not a Planned Parenthood clinic, and maybe it's not politically motivated, and maybe, and things started getting really fuzzy, because people started, political entities in Colorado Springs started getting really scared that folks were going to start to see this as an act of domestic terrorism. And
let me ask you this: did you hear the same good Christian community speak out that this was to be condemned, and there's nobody should confuse good Christian values with loading up and firing on people?
Did you hear
those voices speak out?
It's interesting.
I didn't either.
It took a while. Ted Cruz, who had been endorsed by a radical anti-abortion, you know, one of these guys who is, you know, on the side of violence. He actually came out, I think it was this morning, and denounced the violence. And then Mike Huckabee followed him. So we have two of the farthest right, two of the most farthest right culturally guys on the Republican field, arguably two of the most farthest right, trying to capture that part of the narrative. And everybody else in the Republican field just mum. As a matter of fact, I saw this great breakdown of tweets during the day of the whole Republican field, and nobody was touching it. They were plying their swag on their websites, you know, because it was Black Friday. And so, you know, Ron Paul was saying, oh, hurry up and buy a T-shirt. And Jeb Bush was, you know, pretty much saying the same thing. Like, people were you know, tweeting and promoting all sorts of things and not confronting anything that was going on with regard to this very shocking and important news story. And then today we finally hear from Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee. Very, very odd that those two would get out in front of this story to the extent that they did. You know, neither of them came out in any kind of champion capacity, but there it is, just teeny tiny little, you know, maybe that shouldn't have happened kind of statement.
Yeah, I saw some footage of Jebby, former governor of this misbegotten state, who when questioned on his we should only admit Christians, someone had the actual, you know, newsmanship of asking him, so how are Christians differentiated? How would we differentiate? How do we know if such a person would be a Christian or not? And he offered that famous Bush shrug that, well, we would, you know, just know. So I took that as a real, you know, powerful stance on his part, that we can separate the good from the chaff, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, that really called to mind of, yeah, you just throw them in the lake, and if they sink, they're a witch, and if they float, they're a witch. So
there
you
go.
Have it.
Clears that all right,
yeah.
Up.
And this whole situation is such a mess, because it reminded me of you know, this discussion that we have every time something like this happens about stochastic terrorism and lone gun or lone wolf terrorism. And so, you know, what that's about is shifting the blame from the groups, you know, such as the front group that puts out the video about Planned Parenthood, all the lies about Planned Parenthood, you know, selling baby parts or whatever. And by the way, the shooter actually, you know, said things about, you know, we have to stop selling the baby parts, as he was en route to the police station. So there he indicated there was a political motivation, which was then downplayed by the state's attorney. You know.
Do you know if they stopped to let him get some food at Burger King on the way to the jail?
Good point. I want to circle back to that. We'll put a pin in that, because I do want to circle back to that. At one point, do we ask or do we demand that these organizations start taking responsibility for the terrorism that they're causing in their wake? You know, when they're putting out all of these lies, and politicians like Carly Fiorina are, you know,
right,
put out these lies, and they go out there unchallenged, and it is only a matter of time before mentally unstable people, you know, pick them up and you know, use them as a way to, you know, exercise whatever personal demons that they have. This person, Robert Deere, does seem to be a little off his nuts. You know, he's lived in these teeny tiny little kind of encampments on small plots of land in North Carolina and in South Carolina and now in Colorado. He seems to be a little bit of an outsider. He's had run-ins with the law. He's had some trouble with women, you know, this and that. It does seem like something kind of snapped, and he took it out. He took out this violent act in this direction. But I feel like all of the pieces were laid out by the groups that, you know, put out these videos and put out this narrative and just laid it all out there waiting for the crazy person to come along and pick it up and then terrorize, you know, the people who work at these women's reproductive health clinics, the clients of the clinic, and the potential clients of the clinic. You know, anybody who would dare think to, you know, go to a Planned Parenthood clinic to have a health screening of any kind is now going to think twice. You know, oh my gosh, is this going to be the day, you know, when I go to have a pap smear? Is this going to be the day when a shooter comes or when a bomb goes off? This particular clinic, by the way, had a safe room built in. That is how unsafe they had been made to feel in Colorado Springs.
Well, you know, Colorado Springs has a reputation for being quite a Christian community. In fact, so Christian, in fact, that the Air Force Academy there was chastised for putting essentially religious tests on the cadets there. So I'm expecting any day now to hear a real outcry from them tamping down any of this violence in the name of Christ, wouldn't you think?
Precisely. You need a laugh track that you can hit. Back there, some canned laughter. No, precisely, because we really shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this is connected to this larger narrative of the reaction that we had to Paris. You know, there was the a coordinated attack in Paris with all of the shooters. It was a paramilitary attack where 130 people were killed, and it was a deliberate attack, mission of terrorism to instill terrorism on the people of Paris, sending them the message that no, you can't enjoy yourself in a cafe, and no, you can't, you know, lead a Parisian life, because we're going to get in the way of that. And the message here in Colorado Springs is, no, you can't have reproductive health services because we're going to get in the way of that. And and so we just spent the last 2 weeks talking about how we can't take Syrian refugees and little children coming to the United States, fleeing violence in the Middle East and fleeing ISIS, fleeing the exact forms of violence that we just saw in Paris. We can't take them in to the United States because somehow they pose a threat to us, when really the only real threats that we've seen on our soil have been by these domestic terrorists, you know, Christian white guys who have, you know, opened fire in reproductive health clinics or movie theaters or African American churches. This is where our problem is. And I read an interesting piece today about how it was in 2011. There was we actually had a person in the Department of Homeland Security who was in charge of tracking all of the reports out of the Southern Poverty Law Center and different organizations that track instances of violence and terrorism out in the hinterlands. And he wrote a report on how we need to shift our focus from foreign terrorism to domestic terrorism. And that got him canned from Department of Homeland Security. So as soon as this person reported on what the real problems of terrorism are in our country. He was out. He lost his job. So there's nobody at DHS anymore who's tracking these instances of terrorism. We're on our own. We have to look straight and directly to Southern Poverty Law Center and these independent organizations that actually track these instances.
Go ahead.
Well, and then going back to what happened in Minnesota with the five people who were shot at the Black Lives Matter protest, you know, you have also the Laquan McDonald situation in Chicago. You have this situation where you've got African American citizens and Black citizens who just have no, all they have to do is just show up on a street, you know, hundreds of yards from a police officer holding a teeny tiny 3-inch blade, walking away from a police officer, and they get pumped full of 16 bullets. And then contrast that with this guy who killed a cop and three other people and shot, you know, I think he shot a total of five people. And he walks out alive. He walks out escorted. And like you said, did they pick him up any, you know, snacks on the way to the police station? He was treated like a kid, basically.
We have certainly, I'm afraid that if there's one thing good that comes from all this murderous disaster, is certainly the discussion of how law enforcement operates is being drawn into clear relief, sharper and sharper by all this misfortune. And, you know, you can hardly argue with anyone who would say that Black lives all too often are really irrelevant to what passes for, you know, a high, you can't even say arrest rate, but a high attack rate by some of the police community. I was going to bring a couple other stories to your attention and get your reaction to them. A story I saw in today's Stewart News was the state environmental people want to wring more money out of Florida parks. They want to start allowing hunting. They want to have concessions. They see development, and they see golf courses. And those who are fellow travelers in the legislature want to cut the entrance fees. Now, right now, the parks are raising roughly 60% of their operating costs. But it seems there's this twin attack. On the one hand, they're making the claim that they need to be more a profit center rather than a sink. And the state has put aside no money whatsoever for purchasing additional land. And at the same time, there's an active effort on the legislators' part to cut the fees. In other words, making them more dependent on this concessions and hunting and development and cattle raising on our parks. And I just wondered if when you hear about legislative activities, have you heard any of this part of the Florida story?
Yes, and I have heard that the new head of the FDP is an expert hunter. You know, not much with the whole conservation model, that an ace hunter. So he's going to see things through that lens rather than, the lens of, you know, let's go out and, like, for instance, you know, photograph things or preserve things.
Preserve wildlife,
Yeah, or create more ways that regular people can get out and enjoy them. For instance, a friend of mine a few years ago came with her aging mother, and we went out to a Kaiva park, and her mother was in a wheelchair, and one of the most wonderful things, best afternoons I spent with this friend of mine and her mom, and we've gone back 30 years together, is we were able to enjoy the park together because the boardwalks were barrier-free. so we could, you know, take the wheelchair down and enjoy the spring, you know, with her elderly mother. It was a wonderful afternoon. These are the types of experiences that Florida wild spaces, you know, need to be providing Floridians and the tourism industry as a whole. When you think about the kinds of people who are going to consume a hunting experience or consume a golf experience, that's a very small amount of people. It's a shrinking amount of people, and it's the kind of activity that is going to shrink the enjoyment of those lands for everybody else. In a larger sense, these are also the kinds of activities that privatize the land and privatize the activities so that other people are locked out of enjoying the land and enjoying the activities. So, you know, it completely fits with the Rick Scott model of, socializing, creating a socialist utopia for the rich and a rugged individualism for everybody else.
Another story I saw that I thought was worth bringing up to this evening was there was some speculation that as Negron approaches within a year, leadership in the Florida legislature, there were speculations on whether he'll actually do anything about the Lake Okeechobee outflow as demanded by the public, or will he just roll over because it's too hard to fight those who would refuse to let the state buy any land, you know, those who would go with development first. And I was wondering if you've heard any speculation on these upcoming changes. Now, granted, it's a year off that he'll be taking over his role. But have you heard anything about the Negron position and the failure of the legislature to do anything in the way of Amendment 1's demands?
My faith in the ability of the legislature to do anything that follows the letter of the law for Amendment 1 is incredibly low. And I feel like the Republican leadership in giant square quotes in Tallahassee is beholden only to the Chamber of Commerce and the James Madison Institute. They don't give a hoot what, you know, the voters want or what the voters have mandated, as a matter of fact, through a ballot initiative. So, you know, we passed this ballot initiative through Amendment 1, and they're just, you know, pushing it aside and saying, you know, why should we even pay any attention to that? They're just blatantly ignoring it. So, I don't have many hopes for an insider's game with Negron with Amendment 1. I think that we're going to have to approach this from another. I think we're going to have to be more creative with it, and I'm not sure what that's going to look like yet. But I don't think of his own, moral fiber, he's going to come up with a way to, you know, follow the letter of the law on that.
Let me ask you this. Have you got any latest news or updates on the Florida Democratic Party, so-called?
Things have been pretty quiet over the holiday weekend. And let's see if I've done anything in my notes.
Of course, I got my oblique, my regular weekly begging for dollars emails from half a dozen state Democratic officials, because, of course, now Debbie Wasserman Schultz will, in fact, do something Democratic with those funds. But I remain somewhat skeptical.
You know, there is, okay, so there are a couple of interesting things, I think, going on in the Florida Democratic Party and on that front. And one of them is, I think that things are getting ready to heat up in the Alan Grayson senatorial campaign. I think that he's getting ready to make some moves. I think that He's been laying low over the summer. I think that now is the time, as we're heading into 2016, where he's ready to start, really getting serious about fundraising and really getting serious about getting his political message out there. I think that when we saw earlier this week with the, the Florida Leadership Council and his endorsement, in air quotes, of Hillary Clinton, I think that was a shot across the bow of Alan Grayson being ready to play some hardball. And we heard rumblings of this at the convention earlier this year. And, a lot of people are concerned about how that's going to play out with the Bernie supporters. But I see this as kind of a small bump in the road. I think that Alan Grayson's policies track closer with Bernie's than with Hillary Clinton. And what I hear him saying is that he wants to be in this position on the leadership council because the way he sees it, Hillary Clinton is likely to get the nomination, and he wants to be the voice pulling her to the left. That's the Pascal's wager that he's playing. There's also another side to this, and Patrick Murphy voted for the Benghazi panel, and Hillary Clinton is not somebody who is going to forgive something like that. So that leaves that left an opening for Alan Grayson politically to walk through and say, look, he wasn't going to support you politically on the Benghazi thing. I did support you politically on the Benghazi thing. I've been your friend there, so I'll be your friend here. And so I think that politically there was a savvy move that he made kind of on this higher level that if he can maintain his connection with his grassroots and make this make sense to the grassroots, then I think that that's just going to be a little bump in the road. And all of that is going to hinge on, how he works his messaging out and, gets his mends these relationships with people on the ground. And this week we saw him take on Ted Cruz and say, look, if Ted Cruz gets the nomination, then I'm going to challenge him with a lawsuit for not being an American citizen. And, it's just kind of tongue-in-cheek, and it goes back to the birtherism with Barack Obama, and we don't really see it as a staunch, drawing a line in the sand. We sort of see it as what it is and kind of a classic Alan Grayson move, but hey, somebody had to do it. And it's kind of cute, and it got him a few hits in the media. So I'm expecting to see Alan Grayson in the next couple of weeks make a few more moves, and by, the first of the year, going into January, I think we might even see a little bit of rebranding and maybe a new Alan Grayson emerging. That's just my feel for things. My Alan Grayson stock is rising right now. And I think the more I see people like Peter Schorsch tweeting out things like, who other than the far, far left and Justin Schneider is backing Alan Grayson? Well, I back Alan Grayson, and I know plenty of other progressives back Alan Grayson because they look at Patrick Murphy and they say, ooh, I just don't know if that's the kind of guy we want to send to the Senate right now.
Well, he voted again with the Republicans as well this past week on the refugee issue as well.
Precisely, listen, on the refugee issue.
Let me bring, I need to run a spot, and then I'm going to bring on our good friend Luis Cuevas. I hope you can stick around for some talk there too. Hold on, Brooke.
We'll do.
Okay, here we go. Why are non-religious individuals and families joining Humanists of the Treasure Coast?
Thanks, Rick. People join Humanists of the Treasure Coast to meet other individuals and families who are leading ethical lives free of gods and religion. We educate the public about the positive values associated with humanism, promote the separation of church and state, and work to end discrimination against the non-religious. Humanists of the Treasure Coast is developing a humanist center that provides a supportive environment for humanists, atheists, and agnostics who are tired of feeling pressured to hide their secular outlook on life. To learn more about Humanists of the Treasure Coast, visit us on Facebook or online, or better yet, come to one of our humanist meetings in Jupiter, Stuart, and Vero Beach and join in our discussions.
Well, thanks, Joe, and thanks to the Humanists of the Treasure Coast. And now I'd like to welcome our good friend, Mr. Luis Cuevas of Progressive Push. Luis, welcome, sir.
Oh, thank you. How are you?
Very good, sir. I'm much better now. I was under the weather there for a little while, but I think I've surfaced and shaken most of the dust off.
Good.
And we have our good friend Brooke Hines with us tonight. Figured we could talk some good Democratic politics.
Excellent.
Well, sir, let me ask you first, what has been ticking on your desk just recently?
This has been an interesting week with a rather tragic ending there. What we're looking at is making it, sending out the message and working with our networks regarding all these clowns that are in the GOP and all the stupidity, if anything else, that you see, around them. And what is most, it would be funny if it's not tragic, but the fact that there are members of the media who actually talk to these people and take them seriously and ask them questions as if they were serious persons and say, what on earth? They don't even pass the test to be clowns. Essentially, they're dunces, without any kind of background. They might have degrees. That somebody like Ted Cruz would have a law degree from Harvard. Well, that makes me think twice about Harvard. If I were going to college these days, because then I think that colleges and universities ought to begin to give their incoming students resume of whom they have graduated. Because you see all these, Dr. Bizarro Carson out there with absolutely no knowledge of the world outside of his realm.
You raise an interesting question. I want to ask you and Brooke to think about this aloud for a second. This was, in my mind, one of the big common threads this past week was the issue of videotapes. Now, on the one hand, we hear this lunatic murderer inspired by the famous fraudulent videotape about Planned Parenthood. And on the other side of the coin, we see finally, someone calls Trump out on this insanity he keeps mouthing, especially about the dancing Muslims on video. So we've got a dancing Muslim video that's enraged the Donald and his minions, and then we have this person inspired by the fake Planned Parenthood videos. What's your thought about how, what's the media doing with these issues, and where is responsibility?
For one thing, I would like to know, first of all, what are they doing in our journalism courses and degrees in our universities? because it seems like you have people who are, you know, judged in terms of how they look and the strength of their voices and how they speak other than what they know, and they don't bring anything, you know, out. And the interesting thing is also that in the last month, there has been an upsurge of average people beginning to question the media and what they're doing. It's throughout the social media. The criticism is out there. Some of these people actually ignore it, but I think it's beginning to get too many of them. There is a lack of seriousness. Too many what I call journalist impersonators out there. You know, they sit and they talk and they don't know what they're talking about, and then they issue judgments, which is really, really bad. But essentially, I think that there is a the corporate media itself has a business model, and it dominates the entire system. And unless you get out of the, you know, the networks and the typical press, you're going to see that, you know, you're not going to get much. And I continuously find people who say, "But I watch CNN," and they say, "So what? You know, what do you get out of it? You know, what are the facts there? You know, it's World News Now, but what are the world news? You only hear about, you know, one or two people and this and that and 31 seconds, and that's it." So we end up with a lot of misinformed people. And, you know, as a side to this, you know, the typical Thanksgiving situation when you get with family and you talk and people and all that. Hopefully, I mean, luckily we don't have Republicans in mind, but we do have members of the family who absolutely, you know, they're too busy living their lives and doing their day-to-day chores and working hard for what they have, but who, you know, have very little knowledge of what is going on. They don't really have an understanding of situations. You know, they ask questions, and they are surprised with the answers. You know, in terms of, to give you an example, Dick Cheney with Saddam Hussein and the weapons of mass destruction that we knew, you know, we had already given them. So we knew that those were there, and there are people who still to this day don't have much, you know, idea of that. And so it's misinformation. That's the problem with this. It essentially is that we have a media that plays, and they play for money. They play for, you know, what do you call it? Having advertisement pay for the time and ratings, and the higher the ratings, well, you know, the more money. So when Donald Trump says the barbarities that he says is ka-ching somewhere in a network.
And,
let me,
you
ask,
know, I want to add...
Go ahead, Brooke.
I'm going to add too that it's even worse than for playing for money and for advertising, because there's levels to this. When I started in journalism, I was actually in high school. I was privileged to go to a high school that had a radio and television broadcasting program in our vocational ed wing of the school. And I was fascinated. I was like, "Oh my God, you got a TV studio? I'm in." And so I did that for 2 years, and then started mass comm in college, and I'm like, well, this is for the birds. I'm not learning anything. And switched my major to philosophy and humanities. So at the end of my philosophy and humanities as I was going into grad school, I said, well, I'm just going to join up at the student newspaper and learn the craft of journalism, learn it as a craft to enhance, you know, having a political science background and a philosophy background and social theory and all that. So as a news editor at my newspaper, and I launched my own newspaper out of my school newspaper, I was working with all these J school kids that had no idea how to put together a story. Like, we had the most insane, crazy, huge stories just hitting us in the face, where we actually had, get this, the College of Medicine was called the Quillen Dishner College of Medicine at my school. Mr. Dishner was involved in a sexual escapades in the bathroom of the second floor of the library. They involved members of the football team. And the name Dishner had to be taken off the medical school. And I had news reporters who were like, why would we want to cover this? I'm like, are you crazy?
Oh, my God.
Do I have to explain this to you? This is a news story. But this is, and what they were afraid of was losing access. They were afraid of losing access to the administration, losing access to the football team, on and on, okay? And this is what they're learning in J school, and this is what they take out into the world. So it's not just the advertising and the money. It's each little person seeing, oh, they're not going to call on me for a question, and I'm not going to be part of this. They're not going to see me as a team player. It's that bad.
Let me illustrate that with an interesting announcement I heard today. Chuck Todd, who as the nominal head journalist, I suppose, of NBC News, who hosts not just the big Sunday show Meet the Press, but also now the daily Meet the Press, he mentioned that as far as he was concerned right now, he thought that we live in a post-truth environment. I almost choked on my water. You know, that this guy who is a practicing journalist with a capital J in a big news organization with really so much editorial control could declare the truth irrelevant to the news.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you brought something there. I was going to inject in the conversation the fact that Chuck Todd was questioned regarding his lack of questioning the people that he was interviewing, and he had the gall to say, well, listen, if I'm too hard on them, they won't come back to the show.
Precisely.
That's the kind of thing that goes on these days.
I was just going to say, we've been saying that for years on the progressive side of the journalism, and especially freelance private journalism, that we've been saying that these guys' hands are tied and they refuse to ask any difficult questions so that they can stay in the club, which is what you're exactly talking about.
Yeah. It's just amazing how it all works. And the fact that, you know, once they're in the job, they want to keep it. They don't want to lose it. Chuck Todd, it was, meet the mess. And now he's got this other show. He was rewarded. I guess that's where Marco Rubio gets the idea that, if he he's a slacker in Congress, he can always get a promotion to the presidency, because that's what goes on nowadays. If you're useless for one thing, hey, we'll move you upwards and reward your misbehavior and the stupidities that you do. But essentially, what we have is that if you want to know what's going on in this country, you just turn the TV off and you go to other media. Yeah, because you won't find it there.
I want to bring up two other censorship stories that I found tremendously troubling today. One of them is a story from the, Project Resistance. And they talk about Israel, Google, and YouTube are coordinating to censor Palestinian videos of conflict. Israel held meetings with representatives of YouTube and Google to find ways of cooperating to censor Palestinian videos. The Israel Daily, Merely, and Hovetovli will be working with Google and YouTube officials in a joint mechanism that will be in charge of monitoring and preventing any publication materials deemed by Tel Aviv to be inflammatory. What's your thought on that? Let me ask you first, Louise.
Well, it is what we see there is the preeminent control of the senator from Israel in the Congress and his leadership of the Republicans. And his control of the American corporate media in terms of himself. I mean, when you look at the press in Israel that is trying to, you know, against all odds to stick out some stories and come up with essentially opposition to the you know, savage rule of Bibi Netanyahu, you know, you can't help but you know, roll your eyes and see what's going to come up next, because it's almost like that, you know, the blocking, complete blocking of anything that might even smell of some kind of democracy. And Netanyahu makes absolutely no, you know, allowances for any kind of regrets about anything that he does. And he will keep on doing it. And what you have with the Palestinians is that they are a reservation of people who are somehow targeted for an eventual trail of tears to somewhere, you know, in the world that Netanyahu and his clan decide to send them. That's essentially what it comes down to, because they, you know, they can't send them into the sea means, you know, send them into refugee boats out there to Europe, because there's nothing else, nowhere else to go. You have thousands of people who are living in ruins, thousands of American citizens, actually, who live out there and in squalor. And you think that the U.S. media would cover that? No way. They have, you know, that is all very blocked. That there is a complete, blockage of all that. And when you have people like that Australian investor who now owns National Geographic, you know, the Murdoch, is funny thing that we hear the Donald and the Murdoch. These are the guys who are controlling pretty much of everything right now.
Let me ask Brooke to react to this as well. Brooke, we talked about mainstream media censorship. Now here's more of the internet being censored as well.
So whenever I hear what's at the forefront of what's going on in Israel in terms of like, let's say, intelligence operations, what immediately comes to my mind is, you know, that's the tip of the spear. That's what we're going to start seeing in other places very soon, because these are the types of programs that the United States tends to use as templates and tends to replicate. If you look at when as the Donalds is talking about the wall, you know, the grand wall with the gate or whatever. You know, he's talking about the wall in Israel, and when you talk about these surveillance mechanisms that we would love to see the authoritarian powers in the United States would love to see put on American soil because of all of the threats of terrorism, they're looking at the models that have been developed in Israel in response to those very tight those conflicts that happen in very tight quarters. So, you know, with Google and YouTube being, you know, American companies, you know, trying these kinds of projects, shall we say, with Israel, is really troubling to me because it seems to me like they're trying something out to see how it works, to see if it'll fly, you know, for Black Lives Matter, or if it'll fly for, you know, another conflict in another place where censorship and control of messaging would benefit, you know, an authoritarian regime.
Another story that. Go ahead, Lise. You want to
make I was going to say that I agree, you know, completely, and that few people realize the amount of technology that the Israeli government actually controls and deals with in terms of the internet. Some of our security is actually outsourced to Israeli companies. And you know that, you know, whatever those companies are, there is Mossad. You just, you know, that's part of, you know, you can't give that up. They won't. Unlike our government that just simply, you know, contracts out to corporations, the Israelis maintain a tight hand around those things. And so... just remember, we have released this month, what, two Israeli spies, yep. You know, who were looking into everything that we were doing, and you know, we just gave them some time in jail, but now we send them back home as if nothing.
Here on another censorship front, we see a different kind of action. This is another story from Progressive Resistance. The drone pilot's bank accounts and credit cards have been frozen by the feds for exposing U.S. murder. We heard a story a few weeks ago about the drone pilots coming out and talking about what's been going on in the real drone program. For having the courage to come forward, they're now under attack. U.S. government failed to deter through threats of criminal prosecution and clumsy attempts to intimidate their families. Now, four former Air Force drone operators turned whistleblowers have had their credit cards and bank accounts frozen, according to human rights attorney Jesselyn Reddick. My drone operators went public this week, and now their credit cards and bank accounts are frozen, Radak lamented on her Twitter feed. This was done despite the fact that none of them has been charged with a criminal offense, but merely a formality in the increasingly Soviet-esque American national security state. Michael Haas, Brandon Bryan, Cian Westmoreland, and Stephen Lewis, who served as drone operators in the U.S. Air Force, have gone public with detailed accounts of the widespread corruption and institutionalized indifference to civilian casualties that characterize the program. Some of these disclosures were made in the recent documentary, Drone. Additional details have been provided in an open letter from the whistleblowers to President Obama, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, and CIA Director John Brennan. So here we have four men who went through channels, sent their information. They didn't run overseas. They didn't run away. They faced up. Mm-hmm. They took their medicine. They stood up, sent the information that of their concerns to all the officials, and we see this kind of retaliation.
Yeah.
Any thoughts?
They're lured into taking action, and then they are swatted out like flies afterwards. for doing what they thought was, you know, the right thing. And in many ways, how many other people fell in that trap as they were coming in, and they thought that, you know, they were doing the right thing, and they were going to expose corruption. And in the meantime, they didn't know that they were actually the bait to find out more about others. In the meantime, the really corrupt people, hey, you know, nothing ever happens to them. And that's why many people actually refrain from reporting on what is going on. I mean, we have so many branches of government, so many, you know, 2.5 million federal employees who witness so many things. And we have, what is it, 16, 18 intelligence agencies running at the same time with I don't know how many thousands of people who have security clearance. Which is beyond me, you know, if that's supposed to be so secretive that you have so many people there. But actually, you know, I think that what appears to be madness is really a, you know, rather Machiavellian way of administrators to actually deal with you know, would-be leakers and, you know, people who reveal what is going on.
Thank you. Brooke, any thoughts?
Yes. I follow this story pretty closely, and Jesselyn Raddick is one of my personal heroes and saviors. Taking these drone pilots and freezing their bank accounts and publicly, you know, getting that out in the media and making sure that everybody knows that there's repercussions for their actions. You will be crushed if you, you know, let loose of this information. I think that that's all part of the plan, you know, to make sure that everybody knows that if you see something and say something, that you will suffer. But the thing is that, you know, it's human nature, especially for people who have, you know, hero blood, you know, that you know, want to serve the country and want to serve the country well, mm-hmm. that they're going to say something. You know, when you're sitting behind those consoles and humanity is being reduced to you know, playing Halo, and you're just, you know, killing people like they're blips on a screen, something is wrong. And these guys, the thing that I zeroed in on the story is how they were using drugs such as bath salts as part of the whole tableau of the dehumanizing structure. And I dug into that a little bit deeper and read that how much more bath salts are being used within the military than in the population at large. And I find that very curious, because bath salts have, as an amphetamine, and the way that they work on the brain, have this way of, they naturally tend to dehumanize people and turn them kind of into killers. And we saw the same thing we're seeing the same stories come out of Syria and out of the Middle East, especially with the killers in Paris, where there's a similar drug that they're using that's coming out of Syria that keeps these guys up all night long, and it's amphetamine but has this euphoric component to it, and it makes them feel all powerful, like they're killing machines. And to me, mm-hmm. this is almost like a science fiction thread. Like it's almost too good to be true. It's such a military thread that I think it's almost hard to believe that the military hasn't been turning their head and saying, you know, here's this stuff that people are using, and so what? it seems to be helping them do their job. They're extra good killers all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
One last story I want to bring to your attention is a story where, once again, Doctors Without Borders has called for an independent investigation. Clearly, the military clearing itself, once again, it confuses no one who pays any attention whatsoever. Now that the dust has sort of settled on this issue, the claims and the counterclaims, and now there's actually been an apology issued by the president, what's your take on this? And let me ask you first, Brooke.
Say that again, the Doctors Without Borders.
The Doctors Without Borders, again, are calling for an independent investigation. It seems that the apology offered, that it was completely a mistake and we didn't know what we were doing. It was all an accident.
Yes.
Although the GPSs were dead centered for half an hour with all the calls outbound. Oops, our mistake. Your reaction, Brooke?
It just doesn't add up. It just doesn't add up. There needs to be a full accounting, and you know, until we get a full accounting, until Doctors Without Borders is satisfied, until they're satisfied, until the victim is satisfied, I don't think that anybody should shut up and let it go. They're the ones that need to have, you know, their questions answered to the point that they feel good with their, you know, with what they've been told.
Sir,
you know,
Luis, your comment.
What troubles me is that it wasn't just once; it was twice. It happened twice, you know. And the same thing. And Doctors Without Borders, they know, you know, the risk that they are taking, and they are very, very careful. They've been in so many of these situations, you know, dangerous situations. And what they do is they constantly inform the people involved in the conflict about their location, you know, and all of that, that it's really hard to think that somebody, you know, would just simply say, oh, it was a mistake, I didn't know. Especially when, for one thing, you know, you can choose a target from a, you know, fighter plane unless you're giving those coordinates. That means that in this whole process, there was either a dependence on people on the ground who were not, you know, trustworthy, and that is a problem that the U.S. has had for decades right now, that, you know, we've lacked for intelligence on the ground, that, you know, the fact that we would allow this to go on and say, okay, we go there and, you know, just shoot this, and the way it was done and the casualties that took place, you say, you know, this was no error. You meant to kill, period. Mm-hmm. This was a killing operation. And it brings to mind one thing that ex Prime Minister of Afghanistan, the way that he worked with the United States was that he actually, during the war, he was one of those operators who rode in a motorcycle from one place to the other with a satellite phone, and whenever he called in, he would give coordinates and say, this is a target, and they would go for it. You see, and that's the way that they operate in many of these places. You know, so who's to double check what is there? And they don't want to talk about this because, you know, it's a real problem that they have. And the other one is that they, you know, they have translators problems. People who on the ground are informing them, and then somebody's supposed to pick them up, and they fire hundreds and hundreds of translators under the Bush administration. So this is not something new. It's just simply that we are continuing to depend on very flawed systems. And then when something goes wrong, it's oops. Yeah, but it's not oops for the people who were killed. You know, it's just beyond me.
Well, folks, I want to thank you both very much for joining me for conversation this evening. It was very informative. We got a chance to talk about some very important topics. But I do also want to wish you happy Thanksgiving and happiest of holiday season with friends and family around. We know that these are cherished parts of our lives. And thank you for being part of this adventure. I really appreciate it. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Good night. Okay,
good night.
Now, I do also want to thank our sponsors and underwriters. Now, the Annie Appleseed Project, the Treasure Coast Humanists, you heard their spot earlier, the Democratic Progressive Caucus, a good friend who is a regional patent attorney. You need an attorney, please call us up and we'll give you your name and information. And also various progressive bloggers who support the show. And now I want to bring you Melinda Hemelgarn, who is going to talk about good, healthy ways of enjoying these food fest holidays that we have. So here we go, Melinda Hemelgarn, the food sleuth. Let me say, ladies and gentlemen, I am so pleased and honored to have the food sleuth, Miss Melinda Hemelgarn. Melinda, welcome.
Well, thank you, Rick. It's a delight to be with you again.
Well, I understand that you just got back from a very interesting conference. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, I want to recommend the Bioneers Conference to everyone who's listening. You can actually go online and hear some of the presentations. Now, this year's presentations have not been posted yet, but it's Bioneers, B as in boy, I-O-N-E-E-R-S. So if you just go to bioneers.org, you can see what the conference is all about. They have a tagline that says Revolution from the Heart of Nature. So these are individuals who are giving short presentations about how we can come together and protect the Earth at these very challenging times, say with climate change and just some of the inequities that our world is dealing with right now. The speakers at this conference talk about solutions in a very positive way.
Wow, that sounds so refreshing. I mean, there's so many reasons for cynicism. There's so many reasons for doubt. The tables are stacked against our planet. But that is so nice to hear. Your voice is just so filled with promise and positive energy. My goodness, it's so neat to hear some good news for a change.
Well, I think we're hungry for that. You know, I think we face, as you mentioned, so many negatives. You know, wake up in the morning and there's a headline for you, greeting you. And I think what was so beautiful about this conference is that, you know, you hear from people who are really creative, visionary thinkers and leaders. So they're innovators across this wide and diverse range of expertise. So we hear from climate change leaders, and we hear from folks who are working on grassroots democracy, you know, a woman who has been working on restorative justice, for example, stopping that school-to-prison pipeline, identifying what causes it. I didn't know that so many suspensions in a child's school years can lead, without doubt, to a path to prison. So the particular woman who was talking about restorative justice, and there are alternatives, and that's what this conference is all about. And you can go online and you can listen to previous conferences. I believe the lectures from this year will be up in probably a couple of weeks.
Excellent, excellent. Well, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you was that we are coming fast upon two important food season events. We've got,
yes,
Halloween breathing down our shoulders, or breathing down our necks, and we've also got Thanksgiving. And I thought that what better person to talk to guide us into a Halloween that might be a little healthier, and it might get us to think about a Thanksgiving that would be, should we say, less brutal for the earth, or less earth horrific, or maybe just healthier. Let's talk about Halloween first.
Okay, that sounds great, and I'm so glad you called, because these are my two favorite holidays, honestly. So I love costumes. I love the whole make-believe component of Halloween. And I also love the gratitude for the harvest. So we can blend these in one category. And I should also let our listeners know that I am a mother. My children are grown, but my own children certainly went trick-or-treating. But my children are older, so that when they were trick-or-treating, the candy was not did not contain genetically modified ingredients. So now, if the label says corn, soy, sugar from sugar beets, those are genetically modified ingredients, meaning those crops have been sprayed with the herbicide glyphosate or Roundup. So I don't see candy the same way I used to. The candy that I buy now is fairly traded. You know, Equal Exchange has little bite-sized chocolates. They're going to be more expensive, and I think we have to think about that for families that maybe don't have the money to buy fairly traded organic candy. But what I always did with my kids was we always had alternative things to put in the trick-or-treat bags, and I still do that today. So if you go to some of those party stores, you can get little party favors. And there was actually a study done that showed that children actually preferred toys to candy. So I buy things like fancy, you know, designed pencils. I have little bracelets. I have just little fun things that a child might get in a birthday bag that I give out. I have little small boxes of crayons. And I give them a choice when they come to the door, so they can pick from a tray. I have little buttons with, you know, saying things like spooky. So there are non-candy approaches. And then we also used to have little parties where we would tell scary stories. We would go for nature walks and try to find treasures, you know, who can find acorns and pretty colored leaves. So it's taking advantage of this day to celebrate costume parties for sure, but also tell some spooky tales and have a cauldron of delicious foods like pumpkin soup. You can have spaghetti with tomato sauce, and you could call that bloody brains. You know, there's all kinds of creative ways to have healthy and nourishing fun.
Well, I knew you would be just the person to make those kind of suggestions.
Yeah, I love Halloween.
That's fantastic. Now, let's talk about Thanksgiving. Let's talk about how people might target their preparations, their thinking, so that they can have a healthier Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you know, Thanksgiving, the reason why I love this holiday so much is because it is a day of gratitude. And I think that's what all of us as human beings really need more of. We need more gratitude. We are hungry for connection and relationships. And so this is the day where we can celebrate those things. I always get distressed by these Thanksgiving Day sales where we're moving people from gratitude to consumerism. And people just don't have the kind of resources to be buying more stuff all the time. Our planet cannot take more and more consumerism and just stuff. I think we're all hungry to let that go. So just rejecting that. Now, what my family does is we do have a wonderful meal together. We don't jump up from the table. We don't go to sales, but we do take hikes together in nature, and we spend time in the beauty and glory of this season. So finding alternatives to shopping and celebrating family time together, that is what the holiday is all about. And I think you'll find more sentiment that celebrates that or embraces that. People really don't want to be going out and spending a lot of money that they don't have. I think there's a societal pressure, but we can take back the true meaning of this holiday.
That's wonderful, and what a great thought to start with. I was wondering, I wanted to go in a direction of maybe some warning too. You know, when we think about the traditional Thanksgiving food types, you know, we think of cranberry sauce and that sort of thing. Can you speak to, you know, a lot of people buy their canned cranberries. Are cranberries typically exposed? Are they typically a GMO food, or are they not quite as tampered with as some of the other things we might find? Should people be warned off on cranberry sauce, or especially canned cranberry?
Okay, so just for our listeners, genetic modification, there are no genetically modified cranberries. Genetically modified crops really fall into a very narrow category of foods. So corn, soy, canola, sugar beets, alfalfa, and cotton. So where you're going to find those, because we don't have labeling in the United States, I mean, they have it in the European Union. My goodness, you know, there are many, many countries worldwide that label foods, but we don't have that freedom here. And in fact, I hate to go off on a tangent here and avoid your question, but I have to right now and let people know about the DARC Act, and that we need to be calling our representatives, our senators right now, and letting them know that we want national GMO labeling. There's a bill right now that will deny that from happening. So we, as a democratic nation, we thrive on information. We have a right to know. At least as a dietitian, this is my philosophy. We need to know what's in our food. We need to know what we're feeding our family. And, you know, your question really gets to that point. It's like, well, how do I know? What about cranberries? But cranberries are sprayed with herbicides and pesticides. So what I look for in the grocery store is I look for organic cranberries, because that means that they have not been sprayed with toxic pesticides. And then it's really easy to make your own sauce. You can go online, you can Google cranberry sauce recipe from whole cranberries. But basically what you do is you sprinkle a little sugar on them, you put them in the oven, you bake them, you can even do it in the microwave. And you're basically making your own delicious sauce. You can add a little orange rind zest, you can add a little orange juice, however you like the flavor. But they're very, very easy to make. You don't need to buy a canned product. And remember, too, the canned goods. The cans are lined with a product called BPA, or bisphenol, which is an endocrine disruptor. So I really avoid canned food. Even the cans that say not lined with BPA, the substitutes for BPA have not really been proven to be all that safe either. So when you can, go with fresh or frozen over canned foods because of that.
Thank you. That was the next question I was going to ask. I had a little tickle in my brain about canned something. There was some issue with canned food. Thank you.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. When it comes to ham versus turkey, are people better steering in one direction or another? Or are they, of course, vigilance is always a good idea. But can you talk about turkeys and hams and that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So the week, I believe it's the week before Thanksgiving, or possibly it's around this time, and I don't have those notes in front of me right now, but there's a big emphasis on antibiotic awareness. So a lot of people may not understand this, but most of the antibiotics used in our society are used in livestock agriculture. So first and foremost, we want to make sure that the meat we buy comes from animals that have not been treated with antibiotics. Antibiotics are used mostly for growth promotion and preventing illness because of the way they're raised. So if we remember back, you know, when people were living in tenements, in these close quarters, there was more likelihood of disease. Well, it's the same thing with animals. When they're raised in confined facilities, which the bulk of our meat is, then animals are more likely to become ill. And so they're typically given antibiotics both to prevent illness and to promote growth. Antibiotics in feed promote growth efficiency, so the animals are more likely to gain weight faster, hence our cheap food system, which isn't so cheap if you have looked at the cost of antibiotic-resistant infections lately. So first and foremost, we want to purchase meat, whether you're choosing ham or turkey, whatever you want. It makes no difference. The issue is you want to purchase meat from animals that have not been treated with antibiotics. Now, I take it a step further, and I look for meat that from animals that have not been fed GMO grain. That means you need to look for the, or we need to look for the organic label. Organic means non-GMO, and it also means antibiotic-free. So antibiotics, hormones, genetically modified feed, not allowed in the organic food system. So that would be my recommendation. You can pretty much find organic turkeys. I mean, I live in the Midwest. We have organic turkeys in the grocery stores. Are they going to cost a little more? Yes, up front at the cash register. But when you think about the savings from a overall general health perspective, you can't go wrong. I think it's important to reevaluate some of our food dollars and what we're really buying. It's okay to eat a little less and to invest in our health with the organic food system.
That's a very good way to think about it. I think
it's
that's
an investment.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I think it's also important to think about why people can't afford good food and to put the emphasis on having a more just society. So, for example, we see a lot of campaigns right now to raise the minimum wage, to make it a living wage. This is one of the reasons why we want that, so that people have the choice, the real choice in the marketplace, to buy food that's more healthful for their themselves and their families.
Excellent. I want to take you back to that pioneer, and I'm going to ask you to think about maybe one of the real standout presentations. But before I let you do that, I was going to say, you know, we approach the holidays, we approach this with family coming together, and these are feasts, whether it be the children out collecting with their costume parties and of course the big family dinner and all. If you were to make one recommendation, just kind of an overall how to assess and how to think about preparing for that Thanksgiving feast, What takeaway might there be? You know, obviously buying healthier foods, preparing from scratch more, and going with fresh or frozen as opposed to canned, of course. Any other kind of overall thoughts you might have about the Thanksgiving feast?
I think it's really easy to become overwhelmed, you know, especially if you're the one who's hosting the event. So I want to bring it back to the whole issue of the time we spend in relationship. That's really what matters. We're hungriest for relationships and connections. I think if you're alone on the holiday, it's pretty tough. So find a place to volunteer your services, perhaps. Find some other folks in your community who may also be having alone time. These holidays can be really depressing because we're human beings and we all want connection. We see, you know, we think maybe, well, everybody else is getting together with other people and I'm by myself. So seek out a way to share a meal or to volunteer, you know, to be a true human being and looking at that relationship factor. The other thing is, if you're in a group, you know, try to find good in everyone and share some of that kitchen and food prep time. Make the kitchen the source of the celebration. Bring people in. Help children understand how to make food. You know, I think that making food from scratch, which you mentioned, can seem daunting, especially if we've grown up in families that have been so dependent on prepared foods or processed foods. And one of the best things that we can do for ourselves is to learn how to cook. So recipes are a dime a dozen anymore. Go online, go to the library, find some simple recipes that you can make with your loved ones. And I can promise you that those times together are really what will be remembered and valued. And spend time with older family members and try to collect their family history, because that's another really good thing to do over the holidays, is understand your family's, you know, your family's cultural heritage and celebrate that.
Wow. Melinda, you are such a rare and fine human being. I don't want to go any further without mentioning that you do a wonderful presentation radio show yourself. Why don't you tell folks how to tune into your wisdom on a regular basis?
Well, thank you so much, Rick, for that opportunity. So the radio program that I produce with my husband is called Food Sleuth Radio. It airs on a community radio station. It's produced at a community radio station in Columbia, Missouri, but it airs nationally. You can listen online. It's KOPN.org. And when you go to KOPN.org, you'll see Food Sleuth, and you'll see the list of shows. You can search the archives. It's also available on Public Radio Exchange. So you can just Google Public Radio Exchange and search for Food Sleuth. And you can listen at your leisure to the archives. They're posted there as well. But the mission of the program is connecting the dots between food, health, and agriculture, and helping people find food truth.
You are a rare and fine human being, and I thank you so much. But I want to take
you
back to that Bioneer conference. It sounds so intriguing. And I know you said there were just so many wonderful presentations. If you can pick out one or two that were just standout, head and shoulders above, that people should absolutely make a point of finding on that. Is there any one particular one that really stood out for you?
Well, I hesitate to just say one, because they were all,
okay,
you know, I sat there with my hanky and cried through many of the plenary sessions. But I will bring one person to the fore, and that is Sister Simone Campbell. And her presentation was on community, healing for the 21st century. And for those who don't know about Sister Simone Campbell, I was not one that knew of her, but she's a poet, a social justice attorney, and one of the nation's most influential faith-based progressive activists. And she led, there was a famous 2012 Nuns on the Bus tour, which was set out to challenge the congressional budget proposals that were radically going to slash programs for the poor.
Right.
So what she did was she gave us three virtues for the 21st century. And the first one was holy curiosity. She said, talk to people you wouldn't talk to otherwise and ask them what they're caring about. You know, start a conversation like, well, have you ever thought about this? She says she does a lot of her best missionary work in the grocery store. And, you know, talking to people online, talking to people in the aisles. She said, if we're curious about others, we initiate conversations about the things that matter and that people are hungry for this. The second virtue she called sacred gossip, and she said, share what you've heard. Share the truth about what we find out. And the last one was to sit in reflection, and that is to figure out what is the one thing that we are passionate about. What is our mission? And it's a challenge for all of us, you know, who really care. You know, what is our piece? We are, as a society, a mosaic, right? So we each have one piece that we are passionate about or have strengths or insights on. Let us bring those to the fore and share with others. So I think that's a really nice message for this time of year.
Wow. Thank you so very much. I am absolutely in your debt, and you always bring such a wonderful light to the show.
Thank you, Rick.
I wish you a long and very happy holiday season. I know that you'll be taking joy with you wherever you go. Thanks so much, Melinda, for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
You take care, and best to you and your family.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow, that was amazing. Thanks so much.
Thank you. You know, sometimes the best things happen spontaneously. If we had scheduled this, I don't think it would have been as fun.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
I absolutely do. And normally I have, well, in fact, for this particular Sunday show, I had several guests scheduled. But... Well, that was Melinda Hemmelgarn. And now I'm going to leave you with this final moment. This is from Jan Foreman's Unsung Heroes. This is the story of Mary Mooney.
Here's a song for the unsung working women who worked for America. Here's a song for the unsung.
before America existed as a nation, working people struggled to better their lives, and that always included women. Fannie Mooney was born in New Orleans in 1872. She married a garment worker named Charles Sellens, and after his death, she took up his trade in a shop in St. Louis to support her four children. She later moved to Chicago, where she helped organize the United Garment Workers of America. Her organizing ability led her to the United Mine Workers in the West Virginia coal fields. Her organizing efforts there landed her in prison, though a huge campaign led to her being pardoned by President Woodrow Wilson. In 1917, Fannie Sellens moved to the Pennsylvania coal fields. Despite the violently anti-union climate, she was able to bring thousands of mine workers into the union. She became the heart and soul of the mine workers' union movement in the Allegheny, thus earning the undying hatred of the bosses. Like her contemporary Mary Harris Mother Jones, Fannie Sellens knew that the union movement could not survive without the backing of women. After all, they and their children suffered along with the men. Then and now, a strike meant great hardship, and Sellens was well known in very many miners' households. There was no safety net at all at that time, and Fannie Sellens had to help find clothing, heat, medical care. The coal mine operators made no bones about their fervent desire to get rid of Fannie Sellens. On August 16, 1919, they got their chance. The miners were on strike. Sellens was with the strikers on picket duty when they were attacked by deputies and company officials. One striker was shot as Fannie tried to shepherd children out of the way. She then tried to stop the goons who were clubbing the downed striker. The company official yelled, "Kill the bitch!" They shot Fannie Sellens three times, and as she lay on the ground, one of them fired a shot directly into her head. Nobody was ever arrested for her murder, much less convicted. In addition to her direct work with labor organizing, Fannie Sellens taught immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe who were flooding into the dangerous mines that they did not have to put up with injustice. In America, she taught, though it was an uphill battle, workers were supposed to be able to struggle for better pay, better working conditions, and a decent respect for their contributions to society. Tune in next time for the life of Rose Schneiderman. Songs for the Unsung is a project of user-friendly music, script, narrative, and original music by Joanne Foreman, sung by Jenny Bird.
And that was Joanne Foreman's Songs of the Unsung. And thank you so much for joining us tonight. I'll play a little bit of music on the way out. And you have a good night. And we'll talk to you next week.
Why he say, I need someone. and bury my body there. Oh, I need someone to lend me a $50 bill, and then I leave Hong Kong far behind me for happiness once again. Won't someone believe I begin to see that bay again? But when I tried to leave, sweet local mammals let me fly away. I need someone to love me, need somebody to carry me home to San Francisco and bury my body.
No, sir, Mr. Morgan. I have not seen him all evening. Where's Frenchie?
That's the story of a very unfortunate colored man who got arrested down in old Hong Kong. He got 20 years privilege taken away from him when he kicked old Buddha's bone.
And that's it for tonight. This is PNN saying, talk to you next week. Bye-bye.